Welcome to the Sunstone Magazine podcast, where you get the best of Mormon thought and experience in a succinct package. I'm Stephen Carter. This segment is entitled, Very Careless in His Utterances, Editing, Correcting, and Censoring Conference Addresses, by Joseph Geisner. Joseph Geisner and his wife provide residential services for developmentally disabled adults. He has published in Sunstone, the John Whitmer Historical Journal, the Journal of Mormon History, and Erie Antum. At the Sunday morning session of the October 3rd, 2010 General Conference, President Boyd K. Packer gave a talk called Cleansing the Inner Vessel. However, the talk, as published at the church's website, reflected changes to a few sentences and words. Almost instantly, these amendments were being analyzed in the media and on the internet. Some sources suggested that this kind of editing is actually common for General Conference talks, while others argued that the changes might mark a significant moment in Mormon history. One discussion board comment read, quote, "A friend who recently worked with the church's website confirmed to me privately that all of the talks, not just some, were prepared in advance, run through Correlation and the First Presidency's office, and ultimately offered word by word during delivery. My friend said that nothing goes up on the website until all changes, even minuscule ones like adding, my dear brothers and sisters at the beginning, are reconciled," unquote. On the 8th of October, LDS Church spokesman Scott Trotter released the following statement regarding the edits made in Elder Packer's talk. Quote, "The Monday following every general conference, each speaker has the opportunity to make any edits necessary to clarify differences between what was written and what was delivered, or to clarify the speaker's intent. President Packer has simply clarified his intent," unquote. How often do speeches given in General Conference undergo significant revision before publication? This article focuses on addresses given after the church began publishing the conference reports, beginning with the October 1897 conference. My search found 11 speeches that had either been significantly edited before publication or altogether excised from the official published conference report. Two addresses delivered in the October 1898 General Conference did not appear in the corresponding conference report: Morality and Chastity, given by 40-year-old Apostle John W. Taylor, a son of President John Taylor, and Response to Elder Taylor, by President George Q. Cannon, first counselor to President Lorenzo Snow. Both discourses were delivered on the 7th of October, 1898, and both were deleted from the official records of the conference and are not found in the conference report for that year. They do appear, however, in the fifth volume of Brian Stye's Collected Discourses. Taylor began his talk benignly enough, but then startled the audience by reporting conversations with unnamed men who accused members of the Camas, Utah ward of having a conspicuous number of already pregnant brides, and accused members of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir of engaging in immoral practices. Of the Camas ward, Taylor told conference attendees, quote, "I was informed that 8 out of every 10 of the marriages there have been of such a character that the wives have had children before they were married. Now I cannot believe that in Rhodes Valley the Latter-day Saints are so rotten as this man stated. I cannot believe that they have so thoroughly rotted in the valley," unquote. Then, of the Tabernacle Choir, quote, "While conversing with this gentleman, another man came up, whose word I could not doubt, and he said, 'I was informed by a lady in Salt Lake who keeps a mourning house that after the close of practices by the Tabernacle Choir, several members come to her rooming house for immoral purposes.'" Unquote. After Taylor was finished, George Q. Cannon immediately stepped to the podium, chastised Taylor for his remarks, and tried to soothe the feelings of the accused. quote, "We have regretted, I speak for the First Presidency, that there should be any mention of any particular place as being worse in this respect than others, for we have no reason to believe that this is the case." Cannon said that if there were a problem, it should be handled in a private, not public setting. Brigham Young Jr. recorded in his diary that during the session, quote, "President Joseph F. Smith made some wise remarks, followed by Brother John Taylor, who made some very unwise remarks. President Cannon stated Brother Taylor was wrong, had no right to speak on hearsay accusing innocent persons of immoral practices, laid some of it to his zeal. President George Q. Cannon was very kind to John and allayed feeling which was aroused against John W. Taylor," unquote. During the sustaining of the general authorities, held the Sunday after Taylor's talk, quote, "All were unanimous, but in the case of John W. Taylor. Some few voted against him for his remarks made on Friday about Camas Ward and the Salt Lake Tabernacle Choir," unquote. Following the Sunday solemn assembly, Elder Taylor, quote, "met with the choir and arranged his trouble with them," unquote. According to George F. Richards, B.H. Roberts caused a stir on Wednesday, the 6th of October, 1909, by spending almost an hour, quote, "for the most part devoted to a criticism of the present church administration," unquote. According to Reed Smoot's account, Roberts, quote, "spoke of the faults and shortcomings of the prophet Joseph and others, and the necessity of keeping sacred an agreement, etc. His whole remarks had behind them a spirit of fault-finding, but many of the things he said of and in themselves were fine. People wondered what he was driving at," unquote. Apostle John Henry Smith commented that, quote, "Brigham H. Roberts made the longest talk of the conference, showing the mistakes of the saints during all time," unquote. Apostle Orson F. Whitney admitted that Roberts was eloquent, but criticized the speech as, quote, "not imbued with the Spirit of the Lord. It caused sorrow to his friends, and doubtless gave aid and comfort to the enemy," unquote. Roberts began by mentioning that he had been under the impression that he would not be addressing the conference, but had been called on at the last minute. Indeed, Roberts had been at the center of controversy a few months earlier. On the 30th of March, 1908, Roberts had written a letter to Richard R. Lyman, a university professor, future apostle, and fellow Democrat, which subsequently appeared in the daily papers in early June 1908. The letter criticized Reed Smoot for running for re-election in the U.S. Senate while trying to simultaneously maintain an apostleship. In meetings with the 12 and the First Council of 70 during the 5th and 6th of January 1909, Roberts refused to apologize for the opinions he had expressed in his letter, declaring that those were, quote, "his views then, and that those are his views now," unquote. Members of the two councils countered that, quote, "Roberts ought not to have written such a letter, and that he should have brought his grievances to the brethren," unquote. Reflecting on Roberts' talk and its roots, George F. Richards wrote that, quote, "the argument made by him before the conference is, I judge, the argument he'd prepared for his further hearing about the earlier controversy, when it comes, if at all," unquote. I couldn't find a transcript of Roberts' original speech, but the language of the version published in the October 1909 conference report is still strong enough that it has caused me to speculate on how scathing the original talk must have been. Quote, "truth would compel me to say, as to events in the past, that our people have not always been blameless in their attitude as a community as to the things we have done. God has given us a system of truth that constitutes the gospel of Jesus Christ. To my mind, this gospel is invulnerable. It is perfect and unassailable with truth and reason. To defend it is a joy and always a success. But our history, which is but another name for our conduct, is not always defensible at all points. While the church in Missouri and Illinois never did anything that warranted the cruelty practiced upon them by the people of those states, and in the course of which there were violations of constitutions and the infringement of law, while all that was and is absolutely unjustifiable, yet there was much of fanaticism, much of narrowness, and bigotry, and unwisdom on the part of individuals among the Latter-day Saints, unquote. Doubtless everyone in the audience understood that President Joseph F. Smith's harsh comments at the conclusion of the conference were aimed at Roberts. George F. Richards recorded that, quote, Smith denounced Roberts and his talk in unmeasured terms without mentioning his name, unquote. Orson F. Whitney believed that Smith's, quote, closing remarks were a dignified and telling rebuke to the foolish remarks made by some of the brethren, unquote. Here is part of Smith's reproof. Quote, there never perhaps was a time in the church where there were not foolish ones among us. Some have been foolish through overzeal. Some have been still more foolish through a lack of zeal altogether. Some have been foolish in saying things they ought never to have said. And others have been guilty before the Lord in not saying that which they should have said. I think it is not wise or prudent for me to proclaim the shortcomings of the church, if it has any, or the defects, faults, or failings of its members. I do not think it is my right or prerogative to point out the supposed defects of the prophet Joseph Smith, or Brigham Young, or any other of the leaders of the church. Let the Lord God Almighty judge them, and speak for or against them as it may seem him good. But not I. It is not for me, my brethren, to do this. Our enemies may have taken advantage of us in times gone by because of unwise things that may have been said. Some of us may now give to the world the same opportunity to speak evil against us, because of that which we say, which should not be spoken at all. Unquote. George F. Richards wrote that he saw Roberts go, quote, to the president when the benediction had been offered, and just what was said I do not know, i.e., what passed between them, unquote. Richards then walked up and, quote, shook the president's hand and told him I thanked the Lord for those concluding remarks. I felt they were appropriate and needed, unquote. On the 15th of October, about a week after the conference had ended, Anton Lund, second counselor in the first presidency, recorded that, quote, Roberts came in and told the president that if his speech was radically wrong, he would let it be left out of the conference pamphlet. President Smith said to him to submit it to me, and what I suggested would meet his mind. I told Brother Roberts to make what changes he desired, and we would go over it together, unquote. Roberts' edited address and Smith's address are found in the October 1909 conference report, pages 101 through 108 and 123 through 125, respectively. On the 6th of April, 1915, Apostle James E. Talmage delivered an address titled The Son of Man. On the 10th of May, 5 weeks after the conference, Talmage wrote in his journal that the conference report had been, quote, delayed owing to a consultation regarding my own brief address, unquote. It seems Charles W. Penrose, second counselor in the first presidency, was concerned that Talmage's talk would, quote, cause difficulty to the elders in the field, who he thinks would be confronted with the charge that we as a people worship a man, unquote. The parts removed included two paragraphs, a few sentences, and quotation marks. These omissions shed light on Penrose's concerns. Talmage said that the title, Son of Man, quote, is applied to Christ to express his unique relationship to the human family, that it was one of the highest titles he could assume, unquote. Talmage had also stated that, quote, the Father of Jesus Christ, the father of his spirit and the father of his body, was a man, and has progressed not by any favor, but by the ride of conquest over sin and over unrighteousness to his present position of priesthood and power, of godship and godliness. Unquote. In another paragraph, Talmage commented that if one saw, quote, the Eternal Father sitting upon his throne, you would see a glorified, perfect man. Unquote. This was changed in the published address to read that if one saw, quote, the Eternal Father sitting upon his throne, one would see him like a man in form. Unquote. Although Talmage does not mention it in his journal, Penrose may have had a second concern with the talk. In Jesus the Christ, published that same year, Talmage writes that Jesus was, quote, the only male human being from Adam down who was not the son of a mortal man, unquote. An omitted sentence in the conference address reads, quote, Jesus Christ was the only male human being that has ever walked the earth since Adam who was not the son of a mortal man, unquote. It appears that Talmage was saying in Jesus the Christ that Jesus was the only human born of a divine father. But in the talk, he leaves a loophole for Adam to also be the son of a divine father. Talmage included the complete, unedited version of his conference address in his journal. It was reprinted in The Essential James E. Talmage, published by Signature Books in 1997. Quote, President Joseph F. Smith desired that the full and original report be preserved. Unquote. Talmage wrote in his journal, his theology is found in Chapter 2 of Jesus the Christ under the subheading The Son of Man, pages 142 through 144. On the 7th of October, 1923, J. Golden Kimball, a member of the First Council of 70, gave a brief speech that caused President Heber J. Grant to leap to his feet. According to the Ogden Standard Examiner, Kimball, quote, told of having last year received a Christmas present, COD. Then he pointed the moral. Of course I paid for it, he said. That's the way God's blessings come, COD. You don't get anything unless you deserve and pay for it. The genuine sensation came when Mr. Kimball, bearing testimony to the truth of Mormon faith, said, quote, I know that the Mormon gospel is true, that Joseph Smith was a prophet of God, and when I know a thing, I know it. Why worry about what the other fella says? As far as I'm concerned, they can go to hell, and that's where most of them belong. Unquote. Mr. Kimball took his seat without the usual in the name of Jesus Christ, amen. President Grant at once arose and said, pardon me, but I do not desire that laughter be provoked in our worship. Unquote. The Salt Lake Telegram reported that Kimball's, quote, last statement brought laughter from the large crowd, and President Grant, evidently provoked at the proceedings, arose and said, pardon me, but I do not desire that laughter be provoked in our worship. Unquote. The Deseret News blandly reported, quote, Elder Kimball testified he knew God lived, and that he expected pay for all blessings and promises given. Unquote. On the 9th of April, 1932, Apostle Stephen L. Richards gave a conference address titled Bringing Humanity to the Gospel, which the Salt Lake Tribune described as the keynote message on the second day of conference. Richards expressed concern about members of the church who looked down upon fellow Mormons who used tobacco, tea, or coffee, or those who played billiards or games involving face cards. Near the end of Richards' talk, he said, poetically, quote, I have said these things because I fear dictatorial dogmatism, rigidity of procedure, and intolerance even more than I fear cigarettes, cards, and other devices the adversary may use to nullify faith and kill religion. Fanaticism and bigotry have been the deadly enemies of true religion in the long past. They have made it forbidding, shut it up in cold gray walls of monastery and nunnery, out of the sunlight and fragrance of the growing world. They have garbed it in black, and then in white, when in truth, it is neither black nor white. any more than life is black or white. For religion is life abundant, glowing life, with all its shades, colors, and hues, as the children of men reflect upon the patterns of their lives, the radiance of the Holy Spirit, in varying degrees. Unquote. Immediately after the session, according to Talmage's journal, the First Presidency and the 12 met to discuss whether to allow the talk, quote, to be published in full at this time, unquote. Quote, Brother Richards urged a tolerant and kindly attitude toward those of our people, particularly young people, who become addicted to some habits in violation of the revelation known as the Word of Wisdom. And a question has been raised as to whether the effect of this address will be that of leading to the thought that the Church is lowering its standards, unquote. 2 days later, on the 11th of April, Church President Heber J. Grant recorded in his diary that mission presidents and stake presidents, quote, were disturbed about Brother Stephen L. Richards' talk, unquote. On two different days, the 22nd of April and the 2nd of May, Richards wrote a letter to two different friends, expressing the hope that his discourse, quote, will be helpful to better understandings, and that no one will get from it the impression that I desire to lower the high standards to which we have always held, unquote. On the 26th of April, Apostle David O. McKay noted in his diary that he, Richards, and Joseph Fielding Smith were busy editing Richards' talk. During a May 5th meeting of the First Presidency and the 12, Richards refused to change his talk for publication, and even offered to resign his apostleship. After the meeting, Grant told McKay and Anthony Ivins that Richards had, quote, made a mistake when he delivered that address, but today he made a fool of himself, unquote. That evening, Grant confided in his diary that it would be a mistake to publish Richards' address. During a May 8th visit from Grant in Washington, D.C., Apostle Reed Smoot recorded in his diary that, quote, Grant told me of the unfortunate remarks Stephen L. Richards made at the last conference. Stephen L. was ready to resign, but President Grant thought that would not happen, unquote. Indeed, Richards told Grant on the 26th of May, quote, that he, Richards, felt he had made a mistake by preaching his address, and it was all right with him for the First Presidency to take whatever action they saw fit regarding it, unquote. Grant recorded that he was, quote, very happy to have Richards make this confession, unquote, because he had had a great deal of worry during the trip east. On the 27th of May, Grant told a staff member of the Improvement Era that the magazine could not publish Richards' talk. On the 30th of May, Grant wrote to Smoot saying that it would have been very difficult to print Richards' address since the text would need to be accompanied by a statement which would call more attention to the talk. Grant decided to, quote, let the matter drop, and if it doesn't appear in the conference pamphlet, it will soon be forgotten that the speech was made, unquote. The address was not published until Sunstone Magazine printed it in 1979. However, the talk Sunstone published is not the original talk delivered at the conference. In the original draft of the talk, which has never been published, Richards wrote, quote, some important changes in the ordinances, forms, and methods have been made in recent years, unquote. Both the endowment ceremony and the temple garment had undergone major changes in the 10 years prior to this address, and the topic was still a sensitive one. So, in other unpublished, edited versions, quote, in the ordinances, forms, and methods, unquote, was removed. In its coverage of General Conference, the Salt Lake Tribune reported Richards as saying, quote, I hold it entirely compatible with the genius of the Church to change its forms of procedure, customs, and ordinances in accordance with our own knowledge and experience. I would not discard an old practice merely because it is old, but only after it has outworn its usefulness, unquote. If this report is accurate, then Richards may have been advocating changes in the ordinances of the Church. Also removed from an edited version was Richard's advice that the church should work with members who did not follow the word of wisdom or the church's injunctions against billiards and face cards. Quote, "I would modify the campaign and the council and surround them with safeguards, which I think have often been lacking," unquote. The edited version reads, quote, "But I would surround the campaign and the council with safeguards, which I think have often been lacking," unquote. Despite, or perhaps because of, the disturbance this talk created, Richards became David O. McKay's first counselor in 1951. J. Golden Kimball was again rebuked when he addressed General Conference on the 9th of April, 1933. On the 10th of April, 1933, the Deseret News briefly summarized Kimball's speech under the subtitle, "Prejudice Scored." The report read, quote, "Elder J. Golden Kimball, one of the seven presidents of the 70s, in a short address, cautioned against prejudice, claiming that, quote, no man on earth can be prejudiced and still be just," unquote. The April 10th, 1933 Salt Lake Tribune provided an equally succinct account, quote, "Mr. Kimball urged members of the church to avoid prejudice, declaring that no man can be prejudiced and be just. He said it is particularly important that parents do not adopt a prejudiced attitude toward their children," unquote. However, according to Heber J. Grant, Kimball had told the audience, quote, "God, how I hate prejudice," unquote, and, quote, that he loved some of them a damn sight better than others, unquote. Grant apparently used part of his own speech to take Kimball to task for his off-color language. On the 16th of April, 1933, Heber J. Grant recorded that Edward P. Kimball, Golden's nephew and the tabernacle organist, confided that his uncle's language during the conference session had humiliated him, and that he was very glad that Grant had rebuked him. 3 weeks later, on the 5th of May, Grant went to Golden's office to discuss the talk. Golden was absent, but two of Golden's half-brothers, Joseph and Albert, were present and pointed out that Grant's own published speech would make no sense if Golden's were revised. On the 19th of May, 1933, Grant finally met with Golden to discuss the talk. Here is the account from Grant's diary. "I told him that under no circumstances would I consent to having his speech remodeled the way he had changed it, because it would be a direct reflection on anything I said, because there would be nothing there to criticize. I told him plainly that he must quit using the name of God, that I considered it absolute profanity when he said, 'God, how I hate prejudice,' and when he referred to his conversation with Brother Lyman, in which he told Brother Lyman, in answer to his question as to whether he loved the brethren, that he loved some of them a damn sight better than others, that it was absolutely ridiculous to talk that way. I told him I wanted him to understand that I wouldn't and could not sustain him as one of the general authorities of the church if he did not change. He said he would do his best to improve. He further said that if I did not want to publish his remarks, it would be all right with him. I said, 'I am going to publish your talk, in full, and mine too, unless you want me not to.' He said he would prefer not to have his talk published. I tore it up and threw it into the wastebasket. I was disappointed over my interview with him, from the fact that he did not come out frankly and fully and say, 'Brother Grant, I apologize. I did wrong and I'm sorry.' But we are all differently constituted, and I was glad to have a talk with him, and to have him assure me that he would endeavor to mend his ways. I read my talk to him word for word as it was delivered, in which I referred to my love for him, his testimony of the gospel, etc., and there is practically no criticism whatever in it. I told him that if I had referred to his taking the name of God in vain and insulting his senior president, etc., there might have been some complaint, but I made it as mild as I know how. Golden is given to being very careless in his utterances, and I do hope and pray that he will change in the future. I've always liked him. He is fearless and has a strong testimony of the gospel, but he is as careless in his talk as mortal man can be. He pledged his absolute loyalty to me, but I would think more of his pledge if he would be more careful in his talk, unquote. Kimball's talk does not appear in the April 1933 conference report, nor does the published report contain any reference to his talk. Apparently, Grant's talk was completely reworked before the conference report was published to remove references to Kimball. Though this is only speculation on my part, it seems to me that Kimball's remarks at the conference were extemporaneous. The talk that Grant tore up may therefore have been the one created by the conference recorder, making that document the only record of the talk. On the 6th of April, 1947, newly sustained church patriarch Eldred G. Smith began his first conference address by saying, quote, "Brethren and sisters, I think you are all aware of the fact of the hereditary nature of the office to which I have been called. For that reason, I was prepared to give a speech for this occasion 15 years ago, but not today. Maybe it's because I don't like to get burned in the same fire twice," unquote. Smith acknowledged rumors that Joseph Fielding Smith, not the same person as the church president of that name, had been called to the office instead of him because, quote, "I was not worthy," unquote. But he countered these rumors by describing how he had met with President Grant in 1932, the evening before Joseph Fielding Smith had been called to be church patriarch, to ask if unworthiness were the reason he was being passed over for the calling. Eldred Smith reported Grant as replying, quote, "Oh, no, no. On the contrary, in fact, you've made quite a reputation for yourself in church activities," unquote. Smith went on to detail his activity, beliefs, and church leadership positions in an obvious effort to lay his credentials before the congregation. Whatever the success of this move as far as establishing his personal worthiness was concerned, it inevitably raised the question of, why, then, had he not been called to his hereditary position in 1932? Smith was asked to edit the talk before publication. He did so, but the revision that was finally published in the April 1947 conference report was a third version, titled A Testimony of Truth. In it, Smith's defense has been entirely rewritten to read, quote, "I think that there are probably thousands of men in the church who, if called by the proper authority, could come and fulfill any position in the church. And the position to which I have been called is no exception," unquote. Apostle Ezra Taft Benson made waves when he spoke at the afternoon session of the April 6, 1965 General Conference. He had recently returned from his European mission, which many people felt had been a way of removing him from the United States politics and the John Birch Society. But his political fires had apparently not cooled, and he dedicated his General Conference address to warning about a communist threat to the church. Quote, "The war in heaven is raging on earth today," Benson proclaimed. "Satan argues that men, given their freedom, do not choose wisely. Therefore, a so-called brilliant, benevolent few must establish the welfare government and force us into a greater socialistic society. We are assured of being led into the promised land as long as we let them put a golden ring in our nose. In the end, we lose our freedom and the promised land also. No matter what you call it, communism, socialism, or the welfare state, our freedom is sacrificed," unquote. Benson argued that countries have been pushed into communism by evil forces, and that these evil forces were operating also within the United States. Benson further claimed that the devil had, to a large extent, neutralized, quote, "much of the priesthood," unquote. But if they should, quote, "ever wake up, they could step forth and help preserve freedom," unquote. At the end of the speech, he said, quote, "President David O. McKay has called communism the greatest threat to the church," unquote. Benson's talk made the national spotlight on the 13th of April, 1965, when his speech was covered in a Washington Post article titled, Benson ties rights issue to Reds in Mormon rift. In a meeting of the First Presidency on the 23rd of April, Hugh B. Brown called attention to the negative publicity generated by the Washington Post article and the unfavorable reactions he was hearing about Benson's remarks. McKay's initial reaction was that he, quote, had not noticed anything objectionable in what Brother Benson had said, unquote. McKay then asked Brown to bring him a report of the talk, and Brown told him, quote, he would do it at once, unquote. Later in the meeting, N. Eldon Tanner told McKay that he had also, quote, received telephone calls and letters, unquote, about Benson's talk. On the 3rd of May, in a meeting between McKay and Brown, McKay authorized the elimination of the following two paragraphs from Benson's talk. Quote, before I left for Europe, I warned how the communists were using the civil rights movement to promote revolution and eventual takeover of this country. When are we going to wake up? What do you know about the dangerous civil rights agitation in Mississippi? Do you fear the destruction of all vestiges of state government? Now, brethren, the Lord never promised there would not be traitors in the church. We have the ignorant, the sleepy, and the deceived who provide temptations and avenues of apostasy for the unwary and the unfaithful. But we have a prophet at our head, and he has spoken. Now, what are we going to do about it? Do homework. Brethren, if we had done our homework and were faithful, we could step forward at this time and help save this country. Unquote. On the 4th of May, a month after Benson's talk, Apostle Harold B. Lee spoke at a BYU devotional. According to D. Michael Quinn, part of Lee's talk was directed at Benson and his remarks at General Conference. Quote, it all sums up to this. Beware of that clever advocate, even in high places in the government, or in the church, who deals in cunning half-truths, or who endeavors to win his purposes by twisting the facts, and so seeks for decisions based upon half-falsehoods. Sometimes that happens. So often, men of authority in the church seek to buttress their position by making it appear that they speak for the highest church authorities, rather than to wait until that higher church authority speaks for himself. Unquote. On the 5th of April, 1981, Hartman Rector Jr. of the First Quorum of the 70 gave a talk titled, Will the Earth Be Wasted?, focusing on the themes of family and genealogical work. Rector proclaimed that, quote, the family concept is under very serious attack today, all over the world, unquote, comparing our day with Noah's and suggesting that, quote, as in the days of the flood, he will surely destroy, unquote, the earth. Rector then gave examples of attacks on the family, discussing a TV documentary that had claimed that, quote, old people are dying for lack of love and attention, unquote, that children no longer visit their parents, and that some governments pay people to visit the elderly. Rector believed that because of this government intervention, quote, children no longer have to worry about their parents in old age, so they completely neglect them, unquote. Rector then moved on to what he considered major attacks on the family: sterilization, vasectomies, abortion, birth control, and homosexuality. Rector expressed concern about one-child policies, though he didn't actually name China, because the method of enforcing a one-child policy is, quote, through birth control, abortion, and sterilization, unquote. If a parent has a second child, Rector said, the government takes it to be raised. He believed this policy would, quote, literally destroy these nations, unquote. Rector continued that the Lord would lay waste to the earth when he returned if children and fathers did not turn their hearts to one another. If Latter-day Saints did their personal and family history, Rector promised, their children, quote, will get a great desire to raise a family of their own when they see what a great blessing they were to you. If children have happy family experience, they will not want to be homosexuals, which I am sure is an acquired addiction, just as drugs, alcohol, and pornography are. The promoters of homosexuality say they were born that way, but I do not believe it is true. There are no female spirits trapped in male bodies, and vice versa. Unquote. This talk was extensively covered in the Salt Lake Tribune and Deseret News on Monday, the 6th of April, and in the Church News on Saturday, the 11th of April, with quotations of passages that were later removed from the published talk. In May, the talk was published in the Ensign with the new title, Turning the Hearts. All references to abortion, birth control, sterilization, vasectomy, homosexuality, and the dying elderly were removed, thereby transforming the speech from an apocalyptic Jeremiad to an upbeat pep talk about genealogy. When asked about the changes, Rector responded, quote, "Sometimes it is not expedient to make people angry by telling them in too plain terms what their problems are. The Master many times spoke in parables to protect those who were not able to bear his message. Also, the Church is hoping to gain entrance into communist China, so didn't want to make waves. I presume a combination of things made the First Presidency decide to eliminate certain portions of my remarks, even though they had received and cleared the talk before it was given. It is okay. They know best. However, what I said is still true." Unquote. Reporter Rod G. Wagner of the Salt Lake Tribune broke a story on the 16th of November, 1984, about changes in a October 7th, 1984, General Conference address by Ronald E. Pullman of the First Quorum of the 70, titled The Gospel and the Church. Wagner wrote that not only was the address heavily edited and partially rewritten for the November Ensign, it was also re-videotaped, with, quote, "the new version being spliced into the conference tape," unquote, for church distribution. In response, the church spokesman Don Lefevre stated that, quote, "the most obvious place to retape Pullman's talk was from the pulpit," unquote. But when Wagner asked if this approach could give the false impression that the re-recording was the original, Lefevre said, quote, "it could," unquote. The Deseret News ran a similar story on November 17th, and the Provo Daily Herald on November 18th. Some months later, in Sunstone, Volume 10, Issue 1, editor Peggy Fletcher wrote that, quote, "Pullman returned to the tabernacle a few days after conference and retaped the speech with the changes. This tape was then spliced into the original conference tape, replacing the previous address. In addition, a cough track was provided to make it sound more like an audience was present," unquote. Stack also pointed out that, quote, "the cost of this video editing was between $10,000 and $15,000, unquote. Church spokesman Jerry Cahill was quoted as saying, quote, "I don't think that $10,000 is too much to pay to correct a possible misinterpretation. Besides, if the brethren require it, we comply," unquote. The Daily Herald reported, quote, "Pullman re-delivered his speech in the studios of the Mormon church-owned Bonneville Media Communications," unquote. But this is likely an error. Apparently, church leadership's main concern centered on how Mormon fundamentalists would interpret the talk. For years, general authorities had been countering fundamentalist claims that there were, in fact, two true churches, one church that was a part of the world, and another that followed a higher spiritual law. Stack wrote, quote, "that apostles who regularly deal with Mormon apostate groups pointed out to Elder Pullman that his remarks might be misinterpreted," unquote. Pullman's brother Stuart was quoted in the Tribune saying that Ronald Pullman, quote, "was concerned his remarks would be used by Mormon apostate groups," unquote. Some of the changes support this concern. A portion of the original speech reads, quote, "both the divine gospel of Jesus Christ and the Church of Jesus Christ are true and divine. However, there is a distinction between them which is significant, and it is very important that this distinction be understood. Of equal importance is understanding the essential relationship between the gospel and the church. Failure to distinguish between the two and to comprehend their proper relationship may lead to confusion and misplaced priorities, with unrealistic and therefore failed expectations. Unquote. That portion was revised to read, quote, "Both the gospel of Jesus Christ and the Church of Jesus Christ are true and divine, and there is an essential relationship between them that is significant and very important. Understanding the proper relationship between the gospel and the church will prevent confusion, misplaced priorities, and failed expectations, and will lead to the realization of gospel goals through happy, fulfilling participation in the church." Unquote. Another section reads, quote, "As individually and collectively we increase our knowledge, acceptance, and application of gospel principles, we become less dependent on church programs. Our lives become gospel-centered." Unquote. The section was revised to read, quote, "As individually and collectively we increase our knowledge, acceptance, and application of gospel principles, we can more effectively utilize the church to make our lives increasingly gospel-centered." Unquote. Pullman's treatment of free agency also seems to have been a concern. Of the three times the phrase was used in the original talk, two were removed and the third modified. Pullman stated in the original talk that people should not use their free agency to invent their own values and principles. The edited version reads, quote, "The church aids us in our effort to use our free agency creatively, not to invent our own values, principles, and interpretations." Unquote. After the revised talk had been published, the, quote, "Church Public Communications Office," unquote, revealed a statement saying Pullman had decided that his talk, quote, "might possibly be misinterpreted," unquote, and, quote, "any editorial changes were his own," unquote. In the Salt Lake Tribune article, Stuart Pullman, quote, said he understood the changes were his brother's idea and not due to pressure of other church officials, unquote. 4 years later, in April 1989, Pullman gave another speech at General Conference, this time raising no controversy. A side-by-side comparison of Pullman's originally delivered talk and the edited version can be found in the October 1990 issue of Sunstone. I began this article by briefly describing the reaction to revisions made to Boyd K. Packer's October 2010 conference speech. The portion of his speech that received the most attention was delivered from the pulpit as, quote, "Some suppose that they were preset and cannot overcome what they feel are inborn tendencies toward the impure and unnatural. Not so. Why would our Heavenly Father do that to anyone?" Unquote. Packer ended his talk by proclaiming that, through repentance, people can overcome a, quote, "habit or addiction that is unworthy," unquote. By Sunday afternoon, discussion was raging on the internet about Packer's talk and what it meant for the church in relation to the issue of homosexuality. On Monday, the 4th of October, the Salt Lake Tribune ran Peggy Fletcher Stack's article headlined, "Apostle, Same-Sex Attraction Can Change," the first of many stories about Packer's address. Stack wrote that the speech could have negative effect on LDS church members' attitude toward gay people. She also pointed out that the address seemed to contradict an October 1995 Ensign article by Apostle Dallin H. Oaks on homosexuality, as well as the church's 2007 pamphlet on same-sex attraction, "God Loveth His Children." On that same day, the Human Rights Campaign, an organization promoting gay rights, released a statement saying that President Packer needed to correct his statements, calling his talk, quote, "inaccurate and dangerous," unquote. By Thursday night, a protest had been organized, with 4,500 people gathering at Temple Square to show their disapproval of the address. On Friday, the 8th of October, a revised version of the address was posted on the church's website, lighting off an entirely new round of discussions in the news media and on the internet. The revised version of Packer's speech eliminated the sentence, quote, "Why would our Heavenly Father do that to anyone?" unquote, and replaced the word tendencies with temptations. Less talked about was a change to Packer's assertion that the proclamation on the family, quote, "qualifies, according to the definition, as a revelation, and would do well that members of the church to read and follow it," unquote. The sentence was revised to read, quote, "It is a guide that members of the church would do well to read and to follow," unquote. More than 7,000 speeches have been delivered in General Conference since 1897. I have documented 11 that were subject to significant revision or elimination. Likely other talks could also fit into this group, but for the most part, it seems that general authorities have policed themselves, keeping their remarks within prescribed boundaries. That was Very Careless in His Utterances, Editing, Correcting, and Censoring Conference Addresses by Joseph Geisner. The text version of this article includes endnotes. That concludes this episode of the Sunstone Magazine podcast. Encourage your friends to join us by becoming a patron at patreon.com/sunstone. If you would like to further support Sunstone's efforts, visit sunstone.org/donate, where you can make a tax-deductible contribution. We'll be back soon with another installment of the Best of Mormon Thought and Experience. Thanks for listening.